now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. To Australia.
Well, Dean Haglund, welcome back to Australia.
Yeah, well, thanks for welcoming back to a place you're not actually technically in.
Right, but I mean, I feel like I'm the air traffic control of all podcasts. And you are safe to be coming at us from an airfield somewhere in Sydney. I don't know. Look, you want to welcome me back from the Magic Castle? Because that's where I was before doing this podcast.
Hey, the Magic Castle. What were you doing there? That's my favorite place.
Is it really?
Well, third favorite. But yeah, I like it there.
Okay, we're going to have a little contest. I think the winners that are able to guess your second and first favorite places get one triple XL t-shirt from your friends in podcasting. Maybe a double XL.
Fantastic.
Maybe a double XL.
Right.
But yeah, so write us. Let us know if you can guess. I don't even know what they are. So
I know what they are.
You'll have to write an answer of 2 and 1 to me so that I can know who wins. Otherwise, if I tell you what the answers are and you go, nope, that's not a good one, then that's not really fair. But that was an impromptu game that we've just...
A contest. Suddenly just showed up.
For our loyal listeners. Look, the Magic Castle is great, and I got to tell you, we went for brunch, and brunch is so much better than dinner there.
Because?
Well, the brunch is outstanding. It's an amazing brunch. So that's terrific. And, you know, saw 3 shows while there, and then some impromptu shows. And so it's a great way to spend a day. For people who don't know, the Magic Castle is a private club. First built in 1909, before any of that area was Hollywood, before any of those roads were paved. And it was a residence of the people who founded the Academy of Magical Arts there in what would become known as Hollywood. And in 1963, it was officially christened the Magic Castle, a private club. It is a private club to this day. Public admission is only available through staying at the Magic Castle Hotel, or through being guests of members.
See, I only knew guests of members was the only way. I didn't realize I could stay at the hotel.
Yeah, you still have to pay. You still have to pay for the restaurant and the shows and everything. But you can get reservations that way. I don't know why we're talking so much about the Magic Castle. I had no intent. But, you know, it did occur to me while watching this, and I'm excited to learn that it's a favorite place of yours, because it occurred to me, and in looking through the historic photos, you know, and Orson Welles and Johnny Carson, and so many people you don't think of as magicians first because of the marks they made in other fields, obviously. But what a link there is between magic, comedy, and filmmaking.
Yeah, I know. If you went downstairs to the library, there is also a...
which I did. Got a private tour of the library before even the members were allowed in. I was a guest of the librarian, actually, today.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, the historian.
And he's a magician in his own right, if I'm not mistaken.
He is a she, which is the latest trick that she has pulled.
Oh, well, then I only knew the other librarian who would go and just show you private card tricks. when if you ventured down into the basement.
Yeah, so the library, which, it does have this incredible selection of rare and out of print and ancient texts, as well as some delightful like beginner texts, like Magic for Holidays. There's a whole series of books with holiday-specific magic tricks, but a whole range of things, and it's not available to the public, and it's the one place where magicians and working magicians can go in and work on tricks while consulting these original texts and get coached on those tricks by other practicing magicians. So it's a really one of the things that's fascinating is that they have a great deal of ephemera and artifacts that they're starting to assemble, and they don't really know what to do with it because that's not necessarily a librarian's bailiwick. You need more of an archivist at that point.
Right.
Something we're facing with the Breakfast Club, I got to tell you, it's a challenge knowing exactly how to archive things like that. Anyway, but talk a little bit about the link between magic and comedy. To me, I'm going to throw out that I think they both involve sleight of hand. They both involve misdirection. And they both, when they work really well, when they're really memorable, it's because they are affecting you most of all in the heart.
Well, that's the thing. If you've seen Norm MacDonald's Netflix comedy special, he sort of says that at the end. He says all of this has been tomfoolery and tricking you into thinking it's hilarious. But often it's in the timing and the delivery, which even to the point Milton Berle apparently had a joke that always killed, that made no sense. And part of it was he just spoke in gibberish. But because of his banter and his timing and all of that, the audience was mesmerized into thinking it was another hilarious tidbit out of his mouth. And so, so that kind of magic that goes on in stand-up, it's hard to see, but it is a craft in and of itself. It's also interesting that the original McCarthy dummy is down there too.
Yes,
in the basement.
Charlie McCarthy, of course.
Charlie McCarthy,
Edgar Bergen, and Charlie McCarthy, and of course, wasn't the joke like which one is the dummy? Right. I mean, wasn't that one of the jokes that the dummy says? Yeah.
Exactly, and so it was. It attests to how not just a magic act was the ventriloquism, but the fact that they got a radio show, why would you listen to a ventriloquist?
Because it's not the trick. Because ultimately, when it's great, it's not the trick. It's how it has. Right. It's how it has engaged the imagination of the viewer.
Yeah, exactly. Which is what magic is too. And
exactly.
So
that's a great point.
It does make sense to have Charlie McCarthy.
We could go on and on. I mean, it would be brilliant to do a podcast from there. We've got so much to get to. But one of the things that I never really realized was W.C. Fields was a member, and there's the whole W.C. Fields bar, and his pool room is downstairs. And I want to learn more about his connection to the Magic Castle.
Yeah, I think because it was a private club, they got around some prohibition laws and could serve alcohol there. And so I think because of his boozy nature, during that time, that was going on.
Well, we'll have to see. That would be really interesting. You know, I will say this. Many people remember that, or maybe they don't, but Harry Houdini died on Halloween, I think, was it 1926 or 1927? It was the same year that Valentino died, of all things.
Ah.
Just a few months after Valentino, we just had, I guess maybe it was the 90th anniversary of Valentino's death, and Harry Houdini was at the first of the funerals for Valentino, the one in New York, which was where he died. And then, but Harry Houdini believed in spiritualism, though he spent most of his later years debunking, you know, spiritual charlatans. But he promised his wife that he would try to get a message to her on the anniversary of his death after he died. And if he didn't get it done in 10 years, to give up, that there clearly there was no way to get a message from the other side. And he told her what the message would be. So they would hold these seances for 10 years after his death on Halloween night at the top of the Knickerbocker in Hollywood. And on the 10th year, the couple that founded the Magic Castle, whose home that was originally, they, you know, reported that she was very crestfallen and that the message didn't get through to her. It didn't work. Clearly, you know, it was over. We're not going to do this anymore. But they were like the only ones that seemed to think it was odd that a very giant dark cloud settled over the Knickerbocker and nowhere else. And that as soon as their seance ended, the cloud burst open. They all got drenched. But if you walked out of the Knickerbocker, you were completely in dry, non-rainy terrain. Only on their seance was it raining.
Wow.
So maybe they got a maybe they got a message of a kind. And things to this day at the you know, on Halloween's happen that are very odd at the Magic Castle, not the least of which was a few years ago a big fire that burnt the third floor.
Oh, that's so, right. Yeah, that's right. And they saved it.
Anyway, not a show about the Magic Castle, but 12 minutes talking about it. But not a bad segue, though, when we talk about the connection between magic and comedy, and it is a really interesting one. Hell, no less a personage than Steve Martin develops all his comedic timing by studying magic. He, like Johnny Carson, wanted to be a magician, right? And that was their first stagecraft, was as magicians, not as comics. But we have to begin this week's show, I think, kind of where we left off last week with celebrity deaths, because, well, we need to remember certainly a comedic giant of the small and large screen. So here we go.
Celebrity deaths.
When I say giant, comedy giant of the small and big screen, I am, of course, I'm referring to Jay Thomas.
Wow. Jay Thomas, that's right.
He did die. He is a comedic actor and radio host, and someone that David Letterman once asked upon introducing him for, I think, the 24th time he had appeared on Letterman's show. He said, "Is there anyone funnier alive than Jay Thomas?" So certainly Letterman was a huge fan of Jay Thomas.
Right.
He played Eddie Lebeck, the former hockey player, husband of barmaid Carla, on Cheers, and he was quite the scene stealer. People may not remember just how popular that character and that story arc was, and he certainly seemed to be ready to become just a permanent on that, to take a stool alongside Norm and Cliff and maybe even ride that success into the Frasier spinoff. Who knows? But but some comments he made on his LA radio show involving how he deserved combat pay for having to kiss Rhea Perlman got him fired, as well it should, honestly, because even if it's a joke, it's not a nice one. It's not something to say.
That's right.
And so not only does he get fired, but they kill off his character. He dies in a Zamboni accident.
Of course, hilarious. Because, you know, Zamboni, it's hard to get killed by a Zamboni.
But Diane English, the great...
That's why he left the show.
Yeah, yeah. But Diane English, the great sitcom creator of Murphy Brown, was a fan of his and created a tabloid TV show host, Jerry Gold, for him to play, for which he won 2 Emmy Awards. He also, for Miss English, starred in the sitcom Love and War, which is not very well remembered, but which ran for several seasons. And he played a sports writer romancing the woman who owned his favorite sports bar. And it was a role that he would reprise on other shows later on, other series.
Wow.
Film work includes Mr. Holland's Opus, the second and third of the Santa Claus films. He started out as a disc jockey in college and throughout his whole career remained a fixture on radio in recent years as the host of a Sirius XM radio show. As I mentioned, 24 Letterman appearances, at least 12 that I know of as a Christmas regular. It became an annual tradition on the show where he would have a quarterback challenge with Dave, because one year NFL quarterback Vinny Testaverde was on the show, and he and Dave were having a quarterback challenge to see who could knock the meatball that was used in place of a star atop the Late Show Christmas tree. Who could throw a football and knock the meatball off the top of the Christmas tree? And neither of them could do it, including the then current professional NFL quarterback, Vinny Testaverde, and Jay Thomas runs out of the back, grabs a football, and immediately knocks the thing down. So every year it was him coming back to do it. And every year, Letterman, most years, would ask him to tell a story about Clayton Moore, the Lone Ranger. And I'm not going to spoil it. I urge everyone to YouTube this. It may be the single greatest late night show story that any celebrity guest would regularly tell. It's really worth Googling it. It's Jay Thomas,
wow,
the Lone Ranger, Letterman. Now, of course, the little misdirection I did, the little sleight of hand.
Sleight of hand.
You thought I was referring to Jerry Lewis, who died while we were recording last week.
Right. He may have actually been listening. Oh,
and
no.
We killed him. No, I got slipped a note while we were recording about his death, and then I was slipped another note saying, hold off, it hasn't been confirmed, it's a hoax. And then, of course, it turns out it was no hoax.
Wow.
But we don't want to get it wrong, that's the thing, because if we make fun of Jerry Lewis in his own words, as he used to say, when you make fun of me, you make fun of my kids. So we wouldn't want to do that. But there's the elephant in the room. Jerry took himself a little seriously sometimes, didn't he?
Did he? Yes, he did. Wait a sec.
91.
You make fun of me, you make fun of my kids?
Yeah.
I don't remember him saying that.
Oh, yeah. He people would make fun of him, and he would say that when you make fun of me, you're making fun of the larger cause of Jerry's kids, which was not true.
Oh, I see.
Which was not true. We were just making fun of him. Because of that attitude that makes him hide behind his kids. Anyway, 91 years of age, gained fame as one half of the Martin and Lewis comedy duo alongside crooner Dean Martin. It is almost unimaginable how popular and loved they were in the 1950s. They only partnered for 10 years.
I know.
But during that time, I mean, dear Lord, 12 movies, I think it was. They did 12 movies during the final 7 years they were together, or maybe it was 14. They did, of course, their stage show would sell out. They had a television show.
A radio show?
Yeah. So,
I mean, so much. And it was ridiculous. You know, their rise to stardom in Atlantic City started, it was basically a two-week stint at a club that then turned him overnight into these sensations that seemed highly improvisational. That Dean would croon songs and Jerry would just be crazy pandemonium guy. And for some reason in the 1950s, that act slayed. And they, you know, I love the story of how they promoted that show, where Dean Martin, posing as a lifeguard, would pull Jerry out of the ocean, giving him mouth-to-mouth until a crowd developed. And then Jerry would then spit the water out of his mouth and go, hey, we're on tonight at 8 p.m. over at the club. And then they run like hell down the beach and do it again. And that's how they advertised their show.
I guess they were friends before they started working together. And the first time they worked together was in 1946 in a one-off, when Dean Martin was hired to fill in some gaps in the schedule of a variety show where Lewis was doing comedy. So they were already friends, but they found this rapport that was apparently rooted in real genuine fondness for each other, which is what makes their departure from each other so sad. Because as you said, it really was apparently the more they riffed, the more they improvised, the more popular they became, because their friendship shone through. And Jerry Lewis always said that that was the key to the whole thing. It was lightning in a bottle, because everybody else was working off the scripted page and they were just working off how much they liked each other.
Absolutely. And you can see that support because, you know, Jerry was always so pandemonium. But then Dean would be a great straight man, but also at the same time be hilarious. And, you know, it was a very tricky balancing act that you couldn't do unless you were good friends and had each other, you know, the trust that the two of them had. Each one could depend on the other to either bring laughs, or when somebody couldn't think of something, somebody else would say something, or they could always fall back on singing, you know.
So a big hit on, you know, sold out audiences everywhere. Big hit on television through the Colgate Comedy Hour. 14 Martin and Lewis comedy feature films released in just 7 years, including That's My Boy and Sailor Beware. I have never seen one of their movies together. Never have. I've never seen a Lewis
You've
and
never
Martin
seen
picture.
A...
No.
You're kidding me.
No, I've seen almost all of all their solo work, but never them together. And yet, they... alongside Elvis Presley, were the most famous, best-loved, and revenue-generating acts in the business in the 1950s.
Yeah, they were big money, all right.
It's incredible. So the rift between them that leads them to go their separate ways is... I guess can be traced back to Jerry Lewis's rapidly growing appeal and how fans were clamoring for more and more of the, you know, rubber-faced funny antics. And I guess it began to sting for Dean Martin. He got tired of playing just the bored, you know, straight man role. And then one time... I guess a prominent publicity photo actually cropped him out, and that was the end of it.
That was it.
And it's sad if that's all there was. I mean, although in fairness, you know, Dean Martin had a lot more to offer. I mean, he does do some really good movies as an actor, and he has a lot of serious singing to be done. So one can understand it. It's just sad that the friendship had to end and they wouldn't speak for 20 years. But it can be very hard for some people to walk out without generating anger or hatred. You know, somebody once advised me, said, you know, you don't have to hate somebody to leave. And it's really brilliant advice, but it's very hard to take. We really do, in order to blow things up, have to seemingly, as human beings, generate some animosity instead of just realizing, you know what, I want to move on. And it doesn't have to have anything to do with the other person. It's just my own need, right? But anyway, whatever the reason, they do move on. Dean Martin, of course, goes on to, I would think, even greater heights. But Jerry Lewis, it was very interesting because people thought that his career might not actually survive. And,
right.
And it was a Vegas... a show that allowed him to put the pieces of his disarrayed career back together because he was on vacation and Judy Garland got sick. And as a favor to her, he just filled in at the last minute, singing and dancing and clowning around on stage. And it was a huge hit. And it was proof, though not necessarily that show business doubted it, but he doubted it. It was proof that he had a future on his own. And so in 1957, he was starring in movies without Dean Martin. The first, interestingly enough, was a script that was written for him and Dean Martin called The Delicate Delinquent. And they simply replaced Dean Martin with Darren McGavin, who years later would be the father in A Christmas Story and, of course, an important part of the mythology on The X-Files. Right? Because
he
plays...
He was Kolchak the Night Stalker.
He was Kolchak the Night Stalker, and he plays the FBI agent who investigated the original X-Files on the show. So Darren McGavin fills in as the straight man for Dean Martin, a good casting choice, quite frankly. And then I guess he would do nearly two dozen other movies before the 1960s were up. And among his most notable films, and tell me if any of these are ones that you particularly like, Dean, and if I'm
okay.
If I'm leaving any out. But it seems to me the major ones are probably The Bellboy, because that's his first mm-hmm. as a writer and a director and a producer. And what a strange little film, right? I mean, he's yeah. basically in a silent movie, even though
right.
the
yeah.
rest of the film is full of dialogue.
Yeah, it's quite physical in its comedy, like almost all physical comedy, which, you know, he was a physical comedian, even though some of that sometimes appeared to be very unsafe and dangerous and painful, but on his body. But yeah, The Bellboy seemed to be a throwback for sure.
And you know, the studio was so nervous about it because, like they, I said, they thought, well, but they, you don't speak. You don't speak until the end. This is a silent film. And he assured them, well, no, it's not a silent film because everybody else speaks. And they said, yeah, but the people are coming to hear you. So he ended up having to put his own money to the tune of $1 million into the production. And the gamble paid off because it was a huge hit and almost immediately came to be regarded as a classic. And moreover, it opened the door for him to have more movies that he wrote, directed, and produced, including, of course, 1963's The Nutty Professor, which canonizes him. I mean, you know, we throw around maybe the word icon too much, but so much mm-hmm. of the iconography around Jerry Lewis involves, it seems, The Nutty Professor.
Yeah, I guess, you know, when it said he's best known for Nutty Professor, I was just talking to him, is he really best known for that one? Is that the one that catapulted him?
Well, no, I see again, now people say this best known thing and
all right, exactly.
So most popular for maybe his most seen work, maybe. Though again, I'm going to argue that if when you say best known, you mean what he's most famous for, I got to tell you, I think for several generations it's the Muscular Dystrophy Association. I think he's
right. Yeah, for
sure. A lot of generations, but the thing is, The Nutty Professor is cross-generational. That is true. And indeed, I think a lot of times when people think of Jerry Lewis's shtick, they're thinking of The Nutty Professor.
Yes.
Because it so concretizes an image of him, if that makes sense.
Right. Yes. With the buck teeth and the glasses and the hey lady and the flavin. You know. It's where the Simpsons get their professor from, right?
Yeah.
It's doing a rough Jerry Lewis impersonation.
So he does that. Other big hits of his include Cinderfella, The Ladies' Man, and The Family Jewels. Am I leaving any out that are really worth checking out and seeing?
Well, I like that one that was a World War II parody of The Dirty Dozen, where he plays both the American and the Nazi. Do you know that one?
I don't
forget what it's called. Do you have a IMDb in front of you?
I don't.
I because in Canada, and this is my theory of why he was so loved.
I know.
In France, you know this story.
Yeah.
But in Canada, we get the French television because it's our we have two official languages. So CBC French would show Jerry Lewis movies in French, but purchased from France, where they had the voice artist who did Jerry Lewis's voice, who was way funnier. That voice guy was amazing and made the Jerry Lewis movies even funnier, if you can imagine that. And I think that's why he was so lauded in France, was that his voice artist, the voice artist who dubbed Jerry Lewis movies, was brilliant. So I'm trying to remember that movie.
I mean,
was one of my
favorites. If you look up Jerry Lewis and Nazi, unfortunately, all you get is The Day the Clown Cried, that thing that he made near the end of his career that didn't get released, that is just an abomination. But
right, that Patton Oswalt did the stage reading of. I went and saw that and then got a cease and desist order from Jerry Lewis.
Yeah.
Saying, stop that.
I don't blame him. I mean, hey, he taketh away with The Day the Clown Cried, but he giveth with that performance in Martin Scorsese's The King of Comedy, which is one of the great dramatic performances, one of the great
Absolutely.
Performances that give insight into a comedic performer of any performance ever.
Right.
His upbringing, I don't want to get too heavy into psychology about him, but his upbringing, you know, he was born of a vaudeville family, but they did not take him with them, left them behind.
Right.
And he really felt like he did not receive any love from these parents and was abandoned by them. Another case could be made that, you know, vaudeville circuit may not have been a great place for a kid.
right.
Buster Keaton was there with his dad all the time on the vaudeville circuit, and he didn't receive any love, right?
That's true.
Just beating after beating in order to get it right. So I don't know, you know, they may have thought that they were doing right by the kid. But as a result, you know, by his own admission, his insatiable need to receive love from an audience is born there. And to do it in the way that his parents were receiving it, you know. And that was always ultimately really kind of the weakness that made you at times want to ask him to get off stage, right? It was just the neediness associated with his work. And I think it really becomes problematic after health problems occur. You know, you alluded to the heavy physical comedy he did and the toll that it takes upon him. I mean, he was in and out of the hospital because of these comedy routines. He spent 4 months in the hospital in 65 after throwing himself off a piano and landing badly, chipping off a chunk of his spine. And this would lead to a number of back surgeries, which standing alongside all his other health problems led to just one addiction after another to painkillers. And couple the chronic pain with that insatiable need for love from an audience, and it's potentially a recipe for physical disaster and maybe artistic disaster as well. And certainly he knew both of those.
Yeah, if you want to see very dangerous improvisational comedy in physical. Look no further than the 1970 Red Skelton Hour, where Red Skelton is a magician, and Jerry Lewis is the magician's assistant. And the props and everything, and that Jerry Lewis is going so crazy that Red Skelton actually stops the skit in the middle because it was getting too dangerous and just said, ladies and gentlemen, one of the great comedic improvisers of our physical comedians – and just has the audience applaud right there and stops the sketch cold before somebody gets killed. I mean,
wow.
It was like, it was well done on, you know, Red Skelton's part, but good Lord, man, it was scary to watch.
By the end of the 1960s, he'd become less of a box office draw and all but dropped movie acting in the 1970s, but remained in the public eye, most notably with the Jerry Lewis Muscular Dystrophy Association Telethon, airing each Labor Day weekend, which is coming up this next week, so it's so appropriate to be talking about him. He hosted it from 1966 to 2010 as national chairman of the association. He created, seriously, some of the most see television of the area, most must-see, excuse me, TV of the era, including, how about his reunion with Dean Martin live on the show that was a surprise to him that Frank Sinatra
set up,
because Sinatra, of course, gave endlessly both of his talent and his money, as well as his time, to the MDA telethons. So it was interesting. But over the those years, 1966 to 2010, Jerry Lewis raised an impressive almost $2.5 billion for the cause through those telethons. And then his association ended abruptly in 2010. When the organization first announced that Lewis would only be one of several hosts of a shortened telethon that year, and soon after the news broke that he would no longer be associated in any way, nor would he appear on the telethon. The shorter telethon continued without him for a few years, but actually ended in 2015, so I guess we don't have them anymore. What exactly happened to destroy that relationship between him and the MDA was never fully revealed. And I don't even know if we need to get into it, if we even need to get into what the reasons would be. People can probably Google those and figure those out, and I'm not really interested in a conspiracy involving a child's charity. But certainly Jerry Lewis, both as a filmmaker, a comedian, and a philanthropist, made no small mark on the 20th century and the first part of the 21st century.
I saw him live, actually, one of his last performances 3 years ago, I guess it was, on at the Wilshire. No, not the Will. What's the name of that theater on Wilshire Boulevard? Not the Wiltern, but the other one that they do live performances at.
I don't know, but that's the one where you saw Jerry Lewis at.
Yes, that's the one. At his live show, where it was a lot of reminiscing and a couple jokes and a song or two and some video clips. And it was sort of... But he sat in a chair the whole time, and he was reading a lot of it from scripted pages. And it was sort of, you know, what someone does at the end of their career, where they kind of go over their stuff.
You know, it. We've talked about this before, but sometimes when you go more than one generation removed where comedy is concerned, it's hard for people to enjoy the comedy, right, to find it funny if you go back more than a generation. So, in other words, I guess what I'm saying is you might find your own generation's comics funny, you might find the previous generation's comics funny, but you go back more than one after that, sometimes it feels so removed and so distant, it's hard to appreciate it as funny, but nevertheless, important to understand the evolution of it and the influences of it. And on that ground, therefore, Jerry Lewis might be a head-scratcher for a lot of people, but no less than Jerry Seinfeld said, if you don't get Jerry Lewis, you don't really understand comedy, because he was the essence of it. Eddie Murphy called Jerry Lewis a genius, and Jim Carrey, who has been more clearly influenced by Jerry Lewis than Jim Carrey? He, of course, always refers to Jerry Lewis's work as astounding. Among the many honors conferred upon Lewis were the Gene Herschelt Humanitarian Award from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, a Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Comedy Awards, and an Ellis Island Medal of Honor. So there's quite a variety of
that is a variety.
Okay, this is what we truly call a celebrity death lightning round, because we do want to get to some other things today. But even though Dean Haglund does not like music, we would be remiss if we did not mention that rockabilly musician Albert Sonny Burgess died at 88 this week, jazz rock guitarist John Abercrombie dead at 72, and big band singer Bea Wayne, who made her singing debut at age 6, died at 100. This week.
Wow.
Speaking of very funny people, though, Thomas Meehan, three-time Tony Award winner for writing the books of he's the only writer to have three Broadway shows that each ran for more than 2,000 performances for his three Tony winners. He wrote the book for Annie, he wrote the book for The Producers, and he wrote the book for Hairspray. He famously is the man that made Mel Brooks laugh more than anyone else, and he co-wrote the movie Spaceballs with Mel Brooks.
Wow!
Before partnering with him to bring The Producers to Broadway. And finally, someone that I need to ask you about. I'm hoping that this is someone whose work you know. I know of it, but I can't say that other than one story I've read his. And it's Brian Aldiss, acclaimed English science fiction writer, died on his 92nd birthday this week. He wrote more than 100 books, including novels, poetry, short stories, and nonfiction. His 1969 fiction short story, Super Toys Last All Summer Long, served as the inspiration for Stanley Kubrick film AI, Artificial Intelligence, which of course ended up being made and finished by Steven Spielberg. Aldiss was born in 1925, Norfolk, England, served during World War II as a member of the Royal Signal Corps. After the war, he sold books in Oxford and began writing science fiction pieces for a number of magazines. His first book was 1955's The Brightfount Diaries, a novel in the form of a diary recounting the life of a bookshop sales associate. His fiction works over a span of 7 decades include Space, Time, and Nathaniel Faber, 1957, No Time Like Tomorrow, 1959, The Primal Urge, 1961, The Moment of Eclipse, 1970, The Heliconia Trilogy of the early to mid-1980s, and Super State Orbit, 2002. His last work of fiction was Comfort Zone in 2013. He also edited numerous anthologies, including the year's best science fiction. And what else? He was elected Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature in 1990, honored as an officer of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire during Queen Elizabeth II's birthday celebration in 2005. And here in the U.S., the Science Fiction Writers of America made him its 18th Grand Master of Science Fiction in 2000. What do you know of Brian Aldiss, Dean Haglund?
Well, I actually got to know him through his artwork, believe it or not.
Fascinating. The,
yes. His, he had there was an exhibit, I think 2010 or something like that, in Oxford, but it was about... it was about science, like Metropolis, it was called. And he did a lot of sort of modern, linear, almost mosaic kind of stuff. And so I was sort of like, oh, here's a sci-fi writer who's also an accomplished artist. And that got me into going backwards through his oeuvre of books and stuff. But I think I haven't actually read... I just read some of his magazine stuff, short stories and such. So I can't think of if I sat down to a book of his.
So do you imagine that his love of science fiction expresses itself through his artwork as well?
Yeah. Well, okay. I think so, because it seems that it's, you know, this idea, the approach of the modern, the embracing of speculative futures, as it were, seems to sort of take place in his abstract work, and then I would think that that's, of course, what you're always doing in writing science fiction, is embracing a future idea and writing about it.
What's interesting to me about that, and you knowing his artwork, it feels somehow really appropriate that you would know his artwork first.
Right.
Not that you don't read a lot of science fiction. You do know a lot of science fiction. You know more science fiction than I do.
Right.
But the fact that he was a painter, that you would know that and gravitate towards that, is fascinating and seems appropriate to me. But also, you said, you know, as a writer, what these people are exploring, of course, it would be, you know, reflected. But I'm struck at how that's apparently true for actors, too. Even though we know the role chooses you, not the other way around, what you are exploring as an actor is still you. And so it's fascinating how your paintings, Dean, are very much a reflection, mm-hmm. not a dead-on portrait, but a reflection on the Dean Haglund that people get to know through acting roles.
Well, that's fascinating. You know, it's always forest for the trees that you can't see your own.
Like, you would not look at your paintings and say, not all of them, anyway. I think if someone saw the body of your work, they would come away going, yeah, okay, I believe the guy who played Langley could do that, right? Now, maybe if we cherry-picked certain ones... you know, certain series or whatever, then there might not be that obvious comparison. But I do think, you know, that playing a certain role for so long brought up certain parts of yourself and certainly opened paths to you of exploration, some of which we explore in The Truth Is Out There, that you find interesting. And therefore, when you're putting things on canvas, you're engaging in the world in terms of thoughts and ideas and places that you find interesting. So,
yeah.
So there is, I think, I think it would be interesting then to go for you and look, you know, read his works and see what knowing his artwork does for illuminating the manuscripts.
Yeah, well, now I'm going to. You've inspired me to follow that up. So
you know, speaking of your artwork and the X-Files.
Oh.
I was thinking about this. I was thinking, you know, when we were making Spectres together back in 2003, if I told you 14 years from now, because we finished filming it, I think about 14 years ago, last month or this month or something. It was summer of 2003. If I had told you 14 summers from now, you're going to be living in Sydney, Australia. You're going to have had a solo art show in downtown Los Angeles, and you will be filming season 11 of The X-Files. You may have been able to say, okay, that art show might happen.
Right. I'll give you that one. That
I don't think you were painting regularly at that time. But it had always been a love of yours, and you had voices in your life, both probably within you, but also in your family and friends who were encouraging you to take up the easel again.
Right. Yeah.
But you might have been able to pick that, but I doubt the other two would have been on your agenda, and yet all three things are true. And sure enough, you were in Vancouver this week.
I was
shooting an episode of season 11 of The X-Files.
Absolutely. As I put up on my Instagram, I showed the lovely cover page for my welcoming binder that you get in your hotel room that has all the information about what to do in Vancouver.
Now, you were
hilarious.
You were so guarded that we didn't even let slip who wrote and directed the episode, although apparently you didn't need to be secretive. Since Gillian Anderson's Instagram immediately revealed that.
yes.
Yeah.
Well, so, as, yes.
So Glenn Morgan. As
Glenn Morgan said, yes, he wrote and directed this one. And Glenn Morgan, for those who don't know, originated and created The Lone Gunman after seeing three guys at a table at a convention, like a... conspiracy UFO convention, and seeing three different guy in a suit and a guy in a leather jacket and a guy with long hair and going, what are these guys selling? And put that into a show. So Glenn Morgan and James Wong, the original creators, and now Glenn back on the show writing and directing the second of – this will be second up, I guess –
of 10.
So sometimes they put it out of order.
Yeah, that's true too. They can put them out of order. Ended up releasing them out of order last time. So we got to be careful. But it's one of the first up, at least as planned, for season 11 of the 10 episodes. I'm going to hit you with some questions. We did not prep this beforehand. We just launched right into this. So I'm going to try to be spoiler free if my questions are... if the answers to the questions are going to be spoilers, then, you know, feel free to punt or whatever. But I'm trying to be spoiler free about this, especially because you've given me enough so that I know where some of the spoilers lie. Was there any discussion about you? Was there any discussion about you coming back to Vancouver before they wrap shooting on season 11? And I don't mean with me. This doesn't count. I mean with people associated with the show.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Oh, no, there wasn't. Because I think all of those are already created. So the train is on the rails sort of thing. And I don't think there'll be much room for any sort of changes in cast or planning or swapping out scripts or anything like that. So...
And
there was no talk of that.
But this is a very mysterious episode. You're involved in a very mysterious thing with real potential to be explored later on down the road.
Absolutely. As Glenn Morgan said to me, the TV execs, when they read the script, are going, I'm so glad you found a way to
bring
the gunman back. Yes, to do this. So
even though it was an idea, pretty much, that Dean Haglund had come up with long ago.
Long ago, but, you know, Yeah. This only bodes well for now to put this fire under my ass to finish that graphic novel.
Well, that would be good. That would be a question that would not involve a spoiler. But yes, excellent. That would be excellent. Because I think the where we ended our screenplay when we were going to do a little movie called Back from the Dead, where we ended that is kind of where this seems to pick up.
Absolutely. So it would be a kind of a handy... bridge.
Do I hear? Do I hear us infuriating people who are listening because we're speaking so mysteriously? All right, let me get to more direct questions because I don't want to spoil anything for anybody, but I know that we want to do things. So let's settle this because I don't think this is a spoiler. Nobody is going to be mad on the basis of this being a flashback or a dream sequence or a peyote vision trip. There's not going to be grounds for being upset about this.
No.
You already said that the executives are glad that they figured out a way to bring you back.
Right.
Okay.
So there's no mushroom. Yeah, there's no peyote. Yeah. There's nobody's on drugs.
So when people say to Dean Haglund, you better not be blank, 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 like Dean had any control over it anyway, people, you're certainly complaining to the rock. His only control in it was being born. So anyway, but I'm going to ask you this, Dean, did you pass along my regards to Tom and Bruce?
No.
No, you didn't. I did not. And I figured you didn't. And why didn't you?
Well, because I didn't see them on set.
Yeah.
They weren't there.
Yeah.
So there's that.
Yeah.
So.
And so the follow-up question is, why weren't they there?
Well, because Glenn didn't write them in.
Okay. All right. So you revealed that. Okay. Because that's the big thing that might potentially. Yeah.
Is that a spoiler?
Yeah, so the gunman, they figured out a way to bring the gunman back, but in this episode, it's Langley who's back.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
So
there we go. I think we've done our part. I think we've...
Have we?
Yeah.
Well, and what's interesting is because you see Jillian's Instagram and stuff like that, they're a little more relaxed this time around regarding... everybody's participation in the social media platforms, believe it or not. So,
there should be a little more wiggle room. Just, you know, you either have to pull a full-on David Lynch and control everything, and that's fine because he's created something that is so unlike any other work of art, be it on television or anywhere else. So he wants people to have a really pristine experience of coming to it fresh. So good for him. But you either need to do that in this day and age or just be relaxed about the whole thing. Because it comes right down to it, it's all sleight of hand, isn't it? It's all magic. And magic does not... operate on the idea of limiting access to information. It's more about directing away from sources of information, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you could see that that they know that it's impossible to control it to any degree. So they just sort of said, well, instead of wasting all that manpower to squash this stuff, just let it naturally evolve, and perhaps it will be just like sleight of hand, directing the attention away from, as you said, let the magic be magic at that point.
Now, I'm sure on your flights to and from Vancouver, you probably saw some movies that alienated you. And maybe some that you enjoyed, maybe some international choices. No. I've got a couple of new releases I want to talk about, and we want to get back to questions I left on the table about the British Film Institute list of the 50 films you should see by the age of 14, but we're going to save all that for next week, and we are going to close with something we have not done in some time, because there's two such events that I want to talk to you about. It's a little something we call Live Event of the Week.
The Chilpack Hollywood Live Event of the Week.
So, Dean, going
Thank
in reverse
you,
order, I yeah. was at the Hollywood Bowl this week as a guest of our friend John Girodo. It was a wonderful night out to see the L.A. Phil under the masterful conduction of Gustavo Dudamel. Performing first composer John Adams' harmonium. John Adams was there and was really almost brought to tears by the beauty of how L.A. Phil and the L.A. Master Chorale brought his work to life. Then following an intermission, the full 45-minute Mozart Requiem. And
wow.
I have been a fan, as you know, of Dudamel since he took over the L.A. Phil. I always admire Esa-Pekka Salonen for making the Los Angeles Philharmonic world class. I admired him for his precision. I always kind of felt that the next time he experiences joy will be the first time. And Dudamel was really a breath of fresh air. I mean, just his passion and his exuberance. And to see him grow up in this job has been extraordinary. And he has never been more masterful than he was with the Requiem. And this group, the L.A. Master Chorale, who I knew nothing of until I started appearing regularly on Alex Lefchuk's Midweek Drive program, because he would have the directors and various people associated with the Master Chorale on the Midweek Drive there for Siren FM. And indeed, they performed some pieces on the Mayan podcast-a-thon, which we did in conjunction with Alex there at Siren FM. So I have become slowly a fan of theirs over the year, and their work in this Requiem was phenomenal. And this is, of course, the piece that Mozart was writing when he died. And it was finished, was it not, by Salieri? Is that correct?
Well, yeah, I think the movie Amadeus tried to show that it's thought now that it was also probably because of the inclusion of so much brass. Yeah, there was a student that Mozart was teaching at the time who may have finished it more than Salieri. I think that's a little piece of fiction.
Oh, about Salieri.
Well,
that's fascinating.
Yeah.
So can you make a Is it an apt analogy then between, you know, this gigantic masterwork, whether he died or not, having parts of it done by a disciple, by a student, because it's such an enormous undertaking, this work.
Yeah.
Is there an analogy to be made with some of the grand paintings that the Da Vinci's, for example, of the world were doing, where didn't they have painters working for them who were creating some of these works?
Absolutely. You always had studio and studio assistants who were learning the craft under you and developing, you know, it was a mentorship apprentice program ever since the Renaissance, if not earlier. And so it was with musicians as well. You had students who then, as you taught them, you know, phrasing and stuff like that and how to compose, that they would then take up, you know, some of the laborious challenges of, you know, writing music for different sections and recomposing and adding parts for flutes and all that sort of thing. You know, so absolutely, that was that's an apt analogy.
I also think that far from diminishing the brilliance of the work, it only lends more credence to how brilliant these artists were that they selected as their students people who could not only carry out the vision of the teacher, but in some ways even bring something revolutionary to it that would make it even more powerful. I mean, that's the sign of a real genius, is surrounding yourself with other geniuses.
Exactly.
Even though they may be too inexperienced to recognize their own genius, you know, the students at the time.
Well, that's also true.
So anyway, this was a spectacular night out, and I have never encountered, I've been to many classical events, I have been many events at the Hollywood Bowl, and never have I been to one where the standing ovation was as spontaneous, as euphoric as prolonged as it was for this sold out Hollywood Bowl performance of Mozart's Requiem. So quite a heartening experience because I don't know if you're aware, but you can turn on the news and there's a lot to make you feel maybe sorrowful, maybe pessimistic about the nature of humanity on planet Earth in the first half of the 21st century. But as I've said before, you know, history is never about wars or destruction or conspiracies or darkness. History, when you read it, is always about humanity creating things. That's what wins out. So it was wonderful to see a celebration of this. Finally, something I've been dying to tell you about since last weekend. I was able to be part of a private tour. They're free to the public, but you need to be able to reserve these. And through friends of mine in the International Order of the Eastern Star, I got to participate in a private tour of the Nethercutt collection. Now, have you been to the Nethercutt collection in Sylmar, Dean? I think we may have talked about this before.
I have never been.
All right.
We have talked about this. And it always sounds fascinating, and yet never been there, and always curious about anyone who goes.
I wish you were going to be out here for around Halloween in late October, and I'll hit you with this at the very end. But it's free to the public. It's one of the best-kept secrets in Southern California. It's the product of Merle Norman Cosmetics, the last cosmetics company left in America. Actually, and the people that owned Merle Norman Cosmetics put all their profits into this foundation, and it's the most incredible collection of vintage cars anywhere in the world, as well as the finest collection of music boxes and orchestrions. Oh my God, I'm fascinated by orchestrions. They suddenly went out of
an orchestrion.
Exactly, it's an entire orchestra. In, you know, 20 instruments, up to 20 instruments in a gigantic wood closet with artwork depicted on the front, and it plays tunes, but it's mechanical and it operates entirely on air. And it was completely overnight found to be, becomes extinct because of the introduction of the jukebox. But this was music halls, dance halls, family, you know, mansions. Had music was in an with an orchestrion, and these are incredible. They have so many of them there, and you would not believe it. It will blow your mind, including the one that is dedicated to the Ring cycle, Dean.
Oh, you're kidding?
Yeah,
all of Wagner's
one from
ring cycle
Sweden.
On
I think it comes from Sweden. This orchestrion, and the artwork on the front is brilliant. It tells the tale.
Describe it. I mean. 20 instruments and it runs on air.
Yes.
So, but it has to have moving parts, though, right?
Yes, it does have moving parts. It has the levels and yeah. So
and stuff. And so, how
motors running on air. So you're going to have to look this up. I'm not going to explain to you the full thing. This is what I'm trying to tease people into wanting to know more. In addition to all this, the Nethercutt is home to the third largest pipe organ. Anywhere, 5,132 pipes, ranging in size from a pencil eraser to 33 feet long, the width of a grown man.
Holy.
And they promised me that by the next time I come there, late October, it might be the second largest pipe organ anywhere in the world. The entire third floor where all these orchestrions are, where there's reproducing pianos, where there's a dining room, where there are so many other things, you are actually inside the pipe organ when you are in that room. That's okay. So one of my favorite things, I'm backing up a little bit here. One of my favorite things was the 1933 Duesenberg. I posted this on Instagram. I posed with it. People believe that the phrase "it's a doozy" refers to Duesenbergs, but I got to tell you, I have found references to the phrase "it's a doozy" in personal letters as early as the 1890s. So it's not that. Though the 1890s, by the way, as you will learn at the Nethercutt, is when electric cars were more popular than combustion engine counterparts.
That's right.
At that time. Mm-hmm. But this 1933 Duesenberg, only one in the world, bidding would start at $25 million. $5. So save those pennies. I also love these reproducing pianos. They're not player pianos. They're reproducing pianos. What they are not doing is taking sheet music and performing it. What they are doing is reproducing the exact performance by a piano player. So I got to enjoy Gershwin, who came to the Nethercut and performed on this piano Rhapsody in Blue, and I got to enjoy his performance. And when I realized I was seeing the keys pressing down, it was his pressure being put on those keys. It really sends a chill down your spine.
I bet.
So there's these reproducing pianos. And finally, well, there's D.W. Griffith's camera that he shot, Birth of a Nation, is there on display. Up by the screen that drops down, where they will show occasionally silent films for live accompaniment with this pipe organ. And I thought I had seen live accompaniment. But of course, this organ is capable of doing what so many of the great organs in the great picture palaces could do, which is full slates of sound effects.
Right.
Not just music, sound effects. And anyway, in end of October, they are going to be playing spooky silent films set to the 5,132 pipes accompaniment and projected on a 1908 hand crank projector.
Holy, a hand crank projector. So how do I keep the timing on that right?
Exactly. How did they? How will they? You'll have to be out here at the end of October. I think it's October 27th. I will let people know when tickets are going to go on. They're always free. Every event is free. But, of course, there's only like 300, 400, maybe 500 top seats. So these things book up in a matter of 2 hours. Tickets are limited to 4 per family. But you're not going to be around, are you, the end of October?
I'm not.
Where are you going to be at the end of October?
I'll be in Cambodia, in Siem Reap. At the Angkor Wat Temple, painting.
Wow.
With a group of artists painting all the various temples and sites to be seen that Cambodia has to offer.
So we have so many adventures with which to share with everyone in Chilpak Nation. We are so over time. We thank you for listening to us. And Dean, hang on the line, and we'll just we'll play ourselves out right now.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.